young farmers face many hurdles in their attempt to make it in the industry. Where to find land, how to get food to market, how to balance a budget, and family dynamics are all issues facing the future farmer. I'm Jawalani LaFall, and on today's Central Standard, we're bringing you our second show in an ongoing collaboration with Harvest Public Media, asking, what will the farmer of the future look like? During our first show, we were told by a farmer, Isaac Phillips from Richland, Iowa, that the farmer of the future will have to be a livestock specialist, an attorney, an agricultural scientist, an accountant, and a veterinarian. You have to be a jack of all trades, he says. We'd like to know, do you agree? Join the conversation on KCUR's Facebook page and on Twitter with hashtag AgChat, A-G-C-H-A-T. That's all coming up today on Central Standard following this hour's news. Good morning, Kansas City. It's not often that farming is associated with Twitter, but we recently posed a question on Twitter about the future of farming, and a crop of tweets was abundant. At CultivateKC says that we should localize the topic to the greater KC metro area, and that's what we're doing here today. Kansas City, we like listening to you, too. This is Central Standard. I'm Jawalani LaFall. Today we continue with the second installment of our discussion about the future of farming, a discussion that began last week in Iowa as part of an ongoing collaboration with Harvest Public Media, which is based right here in Kansas City at KCUR. Now we bring the conversation back home. And with us today, our guests are Brandon Farmeyer, a third-generation farmer of Farmeyer Family Vineyard and Farm in Lexington, Missouri, Rachel Pollack of a program called New Roots for Refugees, and Sarah Dehart, a second-year apprentice at Cultivate KC's Gibbs Road Farm. Welcome to the show, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Let's start with Brandon Farmeyer. Farmeyer means farmer in German.
Yes.
Wow. So, two meanings.
Yep.
You literally are what you are.
I am. As I say, I am what I, you know, so I am what I do.
What was it like growing up and being privy to the family business?
It's all I know. I mean, I don't know any other lifestyle. When I was born, as soon as I could walk, I was riding in the tractor with my dad on a traditional, and my grandpa on a traditional farm. And, you know, it's a great life to raise a family. And, you know, it's an extended family because right now we have four generations on the farm all at one time.
Wow. So never did you think about doing anything else?
I was a school teacher for several years, and then I left to go in sales, travel the world in the United States. And then when it came to raising a family, I decided I need to come home and raise my family kind of closer to my roots.
Well, you're raising your family closer to your roots, but what brought you back to your roots, literally and figuratively, in farming, per se?
Just the love of, you know, knowing your food, and, you know, it's one of those things to just watch plants grow. I mean, it's an amazing thing to know you can have control over that. And for me, what brought me back was having kids. I wanted to raise them around the kids and show them kind of things that my grandfather taught me on the farm, show them how to grow plants, and that it's more about looking at the plants and how they grow. And they'll tell you what's wrong with them, you know, if you look at them right.
Today's show is about the future of farming. And so what changes have you seen in farming since you began and since you grew up being privy to it and having an intimate sense of what farming is and what the beginning product and the end product is? What changes have you seen, Brandon?
We've gone full circle. Before, when my grandparents started farming, it was all localized, you know, planting, and then we went to more ship it everywhere, grow it in the perfect climate every time, to where our consumers are demanding, bring it back home. We don't want to see it. We want to know our farmers. We want to know how you grow it, why you grow it that way, and what you're going to do with the product, you know, and how you're going to get it to our plate. And so that's the biggest change. And technology has been, you know, my grandpa never turned on a computer. And so now we tweet about it. We market about it. We have websites, you know, our own website. You know, those are all different things that we wouldn't have done before.
big changes indeed. Let's bring in Rachel Pollack of New Roots for Refugees. Rachel, one thing that's shaping the future of farming is immigrant farmers. Tell us about your program.
Well, I manage a program called New Roots for Refugees. It's a partnership between Catholic Charities of Northeast Kansas and Cultivate Kansas City. And I work for Catholic Charities, and we are a refugee resettlement agency, and that means we work with new Americans from the minute they get off the plane up until they've been in the United States for 5 years. And one thing that we were seeing over and over again was that the people that were coming to us had experience in agriculture. When we asked them, you know, tell us about your life. What did you do in the country that you came from? Everyone said, I was a farmer.
Almost everyone. So you
a lot, yeah,
you
a
do
lot.
Get individuals from other countries that already have farming experience. In
yeah, and of
land.
Course, yeah. It looks different than it does here. But they're used, you know, like you were saying, they're used to that lifestyle of having the family out involved in the farm. And then when they come to the city, it feels very different and disorienting to them. And so we started asking questions, you know, what could we do to help these people do what they're really good at? And so our program, we partner with Cultivate Kansas City, and we've been doing that since 2005 with a network of community gardens for people to grow in for their homes, and then a training farm where people are actually starting small farm businesses. And that's we've been doing that since 2008.
How's everybody reacting to it? Is it working out pretty well? Are the people who settle in this country and do what they did in other countries, are they liking this American
brand of
farming?
Yeah, they love it. I mean, it's hard. Farming is hard. It's not, you know, it's not easy. You don't make a lot of money. You work really hard, but it's very meaningful for them. It really helps them connect to the land here in Kansas City and also to connect to their neighbors. You know, people are buying vegetables from them at the farmer's market that they would have never met otherwise. And so they're able to really kind of get to know the city, get to know the land here in Kansas City, and also provide produce that people are so badly wanting in this area. So, yeah, everybody likes it.
And now we come to Sarah DeHart. Now, Sarah, you're not from a farm, and you're not from a part of a larger program, or you didn't grow up on a farm. You just wanted to farm. Tell us about your journey and why you decided to become a farmer.
That is correct. Upon graduating from college, I actually entered the corporate world, and I was in the corporate world for about 8 years, and it culminated in working in pharmaceutical sales, actually. And I was calling on physicians and visiting offices of cardiologists and endocrinologists, primary care physicians and internists, and I was seeing some really, really sick patients that had become sick from years and years of not having a connection to their food and not knowing what they were putting into their bodies or having a connection to that. And that really struck me very, very deeply, and it affected me more than I realized at the time. So I took about a year off and did a lot of soul searching, and it kept coming back to really knowing, you know, where I wanted to be in the solution was really, really knowing, where food comes from and helping to establish that connection, not just for myself, but for other people. So in thinking more about that, it basically ended up culminating in going back to the source of food itself and growing it. And so I started apprenticing at the Gibbs Road Farm. I actually started volunteering there, and then I was invited to come on as an apprentice. And from day one, I just absolutely fell in love with it.
Indeed, if there's anything that corporate America makes you want to do is put your hands in the dirt.
Right.
What was your first exposure to farming, though? You did some soul searching. Did you just wake up with an epiphany and you said, I know, farming? Like, what brought you specifically to farming in general?
Actually, my very first exposure to farming was my mother grew up on a farm in a farm family in South Central Kansas. And so going out to my grandparents' house and visiting, you know, multiple times a year and seeing the large vegetable garden and seeing my grandfather, I would used to try to wake up early enough to catch my grandfather before he went out. And so we would listen to the AM radio and eat fried bologna together. And that would be kind of a morning routine when I was out there visiting him, and eating off of the land there and seeing that. I think that as I was growing up, I didn't realize how deeply that was rooting itself inside of me. But that's definitely something that I've pulled from and called on in these last couple of years as I've been apprenticing at the farm.
Do you remember the moment that brought you back?
I do not remember the exact moment. I just remembered realizing, over a period of a couple of months that it really came about needing to know where the food is coming from and having that connection with food and knowing how it's grown and being able to share that with other people. And if doing that on a local level really feeds a local economy in a time that we're all needing our local economy to be fed. And so that was just more of a greater impetus for me.
You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 FM KCUR, streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm your host, Jabalani LaFall. Today, we continue the discussion in our second installment of our talk about the future of farming, a discussion that began last week in Iowa as part of an ongoing collaboration with Harvest Public Media, which is based here in Kansas City. We bring the conversation back home with our guest, Brandon Farmeyer, a third-generation farmer at Farmeyer Family Vineyard and Farm in Lexington, Missouri, Rachel Pollack, who's with a program with Catholic Charities called New Roots for Refugees, and she's sharing a story of the program that trains refugees to start their own farm businesses, and Sarah DeHart from Pharmaceuticals, from Big Pharma to Small Farm. She's a second-year apprentice at Cultivate KC's Gibb Rhodes Farm, and you might catch her making deliveries of fresh produce to some of your favorite local spots. Kansas City, what do you think the farmer of the future looks like? Give us a call at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or shoot us an email at centralstandard@kcur.org. Already on Facebook, Courtney writes, the future of farmers are cyborgs, cyborg farmers. We assure you all of our guests are completely human. But we are welcoming comments on Facebook and Twitter. And once again, the number is 816-235-2888, 816-235-2888. And we had a comment on KCUR.org that I'd like to pose as a question to all of you, speaking of cyborgs. It deals with the increasingly mechanized world and the technological aspects of farming. Our listener, Ann, asks, won't the farmer of the future not be a farmer at all, just machines? We'll begin with Brandon Farmeyer. What are your thoughts on that?
I would say that machines are a tool to be, as our population grows, these machines, i.e., global positioning and things like that, allow the farmer to be more efficient. The farmer still has to be in touch with the product. There's not going to be machines that can tell a farmer, and there probably is machines that will tell, but not to the extent. And there's something to be said about going out, touching it, and being out in the field. You can't see that with a machine. And that's going to be more on the large farms. When it comes to produce and things that we're going to eat on a daily basis, those are probably going to be more hand. It's a lot of hand labor. And it's hard to pick a tomato, without bruising it with your bare fingers, let alone pick it with a machine. And so I think there's going to be a mix of things. It'll never completely take over for way past our time in life.
Sarah DeHart, what is that manual or woe manual label like?
I absolutely agree with Brandon about, tools can definitely, or mechanization can definitely be a resource or a tool, but there is something to be said for going out and literally reading a field. And at the Gibbs Road farm, it is a training and demonstration farm where I work, and a lot of it is, we hand sow it, we hand weed it, we hand harvest, we wash by hand. Everything is done by hand, and it really does provide a grounding. You really do develop a connection to the land that you're at, and I think that that's a really, really important thing. I think that, again, there are certain tools that are available, but when it comes down to being able to know when a specific crop is ready or to be able to see that a specific crop needs some sort of attention or is demonstrating a certain deficiency of a nutrient or even just maybe needs a little bit more water or is getting too much sun, that's all absolutely necessary to come from the farmer itself. And I don't know that a machine could ever replace that.
Rachel Pollack, in some areas of the world, the farming techniques are literally thousands of years old. They haven't mechanized at all. Have you heard from any of the local people at Cultivate KC and at some of your farming partners on some of the intrinsic methods some of these immigrants bring to the farming process itself that help them learn something.
Yeah, I would say that our farmers that are coming from these different countries, initially we thought we're going to teach them so much about all these different tools and methods of doing things, and really I feel like we've learned from them so much about how good a product in a field can look when it's all done by hand, when it's all cared for. The folks that I work with treat their fields like it's home, like it's a work of art. and no matter what type of tool it is, a lot of times they resist it because they really like being involved on the deepest level with their product and caring for it. And they're able to get a lot more product out of a smaller space growing it in that way. So I think I've actually learned a lot more from these folks about lower mechanization and simpler tools and how those can be really effective.
Brandon Farmeyer, you've been in farming for the greater part of your life, but we have people here on the line and a guest here, Sarah Dehart, that is actually getting into farmers. What about going forward, looking at the future of farming, the access to land? Farmland has experienced a sizable increase in prices in recent years. How does that enlarge barriers to entry for someone looking to get into farming?
It's huge. I mean, there's no other way to put it. I mean, even coming back to the farm, having a family that's been in the farm forever, I mean, we couldn't be doing what we're doing without the help of my grandparents and my parents and my brothers. I mean, it's a completely, and we have a lot of great employees that help us as well. But, I mean, I envy the ambition of them to take on the challenge like this. I mean, it's a highly – and it's a very capital intensive business. And, with a lot of the corporate farms, they're trying to buy up land as fast as they can.
Right. And a lot of the family farms are being sold as part of this boom because the prices that you're getting for selling farmland is in some ways irresistible. And there's a larger trend in corporate monocropping as well that drives the price of that land up. Why have you and your family chosen to, for lack of a better word, stand your ground?
For us, it really stemmed from the fact that we have a lot of large farmers in our area, and they're really close family friends. I mean, we grew up with them our whole life, and it was one of those things where you either decide to get big with all the rest of them and fight over land, pay high cash rents or whatever, or you change. And we, all three boys, had left the farm and went to college, and when we came back to school, we saw a lot of opportunities in local produce, local wine, and so our business changed. And even in agritourism with tours to the farm and tours to the vineyard, and I mean, we even have live music out at the winery now. So it's completely evolved to a totally different type of farm than it used to be, but it allows us to keep our farm small where we're in touch with everything. And we get to meet our customers because they come out and interact with us on a one-to-one basis, And most of our customers, after two or three visits, I'll know them by name, and we greet them at the tasting room or whatever. They come out to buy flowers or buy produce or whatever. Our name is Farmeyer Family, and it's the family encompasses our customers as much as just our family.
We're talking the future of farming with Farmer Brandon Farmeyer and Sarah Dehart, an urban farmer here at the Gibbs Farm in KCK, and Rachel Pollack of a program called New Roots for Refugees, bringing immigrant farmers to American farms in rural and urban settings alike. 816-235-2888. What do you think, Kansas City, is the future of farming? Let's hear from Chris in Overland Park. Welcome to Central Standard, Chris.
Hi, how are you guys? My question about the future of farming is, with the large corporate farming and the corn subsidies and, the large movement for companies like Monsanto and others to really have an iron grip on the farmer, is the future of farming even something that we can visualize without, throwing off corporate hand, and how would that happen, and is there a movement among the farmers and the people that they know where that's starting to happen, where people are going back to their roots?
That's a very interesting question from Chris in Overland Park. The influence of corporate farming in order to have farmers of the future and start small, does it need to be reversed? Is there a way that large corporate farms can be included? What's the end game here, or the go ahead game?
For me, I would say there's a spot for all of these types of farms, whether they're large or small. The consumer's really looking for in touch with their food. You know, some of the products that we're making or the large corporations farming are making are not something that can be easily done on a small scale with a lot of labor. The margins that the farmers operate on are so slim. That's why they've become extremely mechanized and the equipment's gotten really large. You know, when I started farming, we were with a 4-row planter. You know, now they've got 30-row planters pulled by the same man in a tractor because he has to cover so much ground in such a short period of time to make a profit. But then on the produce side, you know, you can do so much more with so little ground if you do it by hand because you don't have the impact on the ground. So it, with the cost of land rising, you'll see a lot of small farms dotting in the area.
Are small farms sort of becoming like big gardens with a more variety of crops?
I think so in some ways. I think that, you know, for instance, the Gibbs Road farm is on 2-acre certified organic, and those 2 acres have been farmed organically since 1997, and we grow over 40 crops and over 250 different varieties. And that's something that's being done on 2 acres. That's probably absolutely impossible to do that on a much larger scale because of what Brandon was talking about. You know, when you have these huge, huge machines, that's going to compact the soil and prevent that from being able to be done. So you can definitely get more variance in terms of there definitely are a number of small gardens and community gardens popping up around the city and smaller plots, maybe unused land that are being used and turned in for farming. So if they're gardening, they're just feeding themselves. Whoever's gardening in it is maybe just feeding themselves and their neighbors. And if they're farming, then they're farming for market and they're selling it at market or they're selling it to restaurants and they're using the land to try to supplement their income or completely get most or all of their income from it. So I think that, you know, to answer Chris's question, what's that look like in the greater scale of things? I couldn't agree more with Brandon. There's a place for all of it. There's definitely a need for large scale right now. I wouldn't say that that the large scale companies need to just vanish because they are serving a purpose. However, I think that there's also a need to develop regional food distribution supplies and local and the local food economy and the local food industry as well, not just from the local economy and how that will feed it, but also feeding our city and feeding each other. And I think that it's going to take a bunch of different creative minds to come together to create the solutions to make all of that viable.
You'd like to own your own land one day, Sarah. What are the challenges or barriers to entry that you're hearing about?
I think that, you know, access to land and access to capital and land that has access to water are definitely among the most important. And those are going to be some of the most difficult. But even then, you know, it is a really ambitious, and sometimes I think my friends and my family think I'm absolutely crazy for even going this route. But I definitely see solutions, and I see solutions all around me. There are a number of different people, farmers, that have created really interesting solutions in order to do this. There is there's a couple of ladies that were an apprentice at the farm, I think maybe 3 years ago, and now they're in a situation where they are using an old-time farmer's land and equipment, and they're farming his land and using his equipment, and then they're all three profit sharing. And that's happening in Central Missouri, and that's a fantastic business model that's working for them. There's a gentleman who has set up more of like an urban garden behind a restaurant here in town. And I think the restaurant is subsidizing some of the seed cost and maybe some of the water, and then he's farming it, and then in return giving that produce to the restaurant, you know, and that's Nick Garcia and Westside Local. There's some very interesting and creative solutions that are coming up that are definitely out there. Again, and then also really recently, House Bill 1659 just passed in Kansas City to allow for the ability for a land trust to be created. And that's just going to provide more opportunity for access to land in the city.
What other ideas do you bring, you feel, from a non-farm world that you've seen work in the context of urban farming and local food production? You mentioned Westside Local, delicious food, local food right there.
Mm-hmm.
What are the ideas that you think from the non-farm world that could apply?
You know, I don't necessarily think that I bring anything that's completely reinventing the wheel or that's in a new invention. I think it's just a matter of teaming up all of your resources and figuring out how it's going to work, because every single farmer and every single plot of land and every single market and distribution channel is going to create a different set of opportunities and challenges that are going to be absolutely unique to all of those situations. I think that there is a demand for fresh local food, not just people going to a farmer's market and purchasing it, but also people want to see that on the menus in restaurants. People don't have the time to go to farmer's markets on Saturday mornings or Wednesday afternoons. There are more and more popping up around the city, so there are more opportunities for people to go, but it's still difficult to sometimes for people to fit that in. So, you know, having a hybrid or an amalgamation of a CSA offering and selling wholesale to restaurants and maybe having a market presence, all of those things become important, and figuring out exactly what's going to work best to create your unique business model is going to be what's going to be most important for me, I think.
We continue our discussion that began last week as part of an ongoing collaboration with Harvest Public Media. The show topic today is, what is the future of farming? Brandon Farmeyer, a third-generation farmer of the Farmeyer family farm in Lexington, Missouri, and vineyard, I should add, in Lexington, Missouri, is here, along with Rachel Pollack of New Roots for Refugees and Sarah DeHart, whose voice you just heard, a second-year apprentice at Cultivate KC's Gibbs Road Farm in KCK, who you might catch making deliveries of fresh produce at some of your local spots. Kansas City, are you a young farmer trying to get your start? What drew you to the business, and what obstacles are you facing? What does the farmer of the future look like? Give us a call at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888, or shoot us an email at centralstandard@kcur.org. You can also join the conversation at KCUR's Facebook page and on Twitter with the hashtag AgChat. That's A-G-C-H-A-T. We're going to take a quick break. When we return, more on the future of farming. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Jabalani LaFall. Former President Dwight D. Eisenhower said farming looks mighty easy when you plow with a pencil and you're 1,000 miles from the corn field. But it's not too easy on the ground, and even less so if you're looking to get into farming. We now continue our second installment of our discussion on the future of farming. It began last week in Iowa City as part of a collaboration with Iowa Public Media and Harvest Public Media, which is based here in Kansas City. Now we bring the conversation back home. Our guests are Brandon Farmeyer, a third-generation farmer of Farmeyer Family Vineyard and Farm in Lexington, Missouri, Rachel Pollack with a program called New Roots for Refugees, and Sarah DeHart, a second-year apprentice at Cultivate KC. Kansas City, what do you think the farmer of the future looks like? Give us a call at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or shoot us an email at centralstandard.org. We're talking about the farmer of the future and farming of the future. Kevin in St. Joe, welcome to Central Standard.
Hi, everybody. I think that the future of farming is we need to get out of the dirt. We need to get into water. And I'm not really talking about hydroponics. We need to get into a thing called aquaponics, where you actually introduce fish into the closed loop water cycle of the plants. I've done quite a bit of work and research on that over the last year, and I've been starting to do some trials in my backyard where I've got a small dirt garden, and right next to it, I've got a closed loop aquaponics garden that's about half of the size. And so what I'm doing over the next, you know, year is I want to start taking scientific notes as far as plant sizes and produce and yields and that sort of thing. But I was wondering if you guys know anything about it and what you guys see the future of farming if aquaponics is going to be involved in that.
Brandon, you have a loose experience with aquaponics. Tell us about it.
We had an aquaculture, aquaponics type program at high school. The biggest thing I see in the Midwest, and at least in my opinion, is the cold temperatures during winter and dealing with the heating and cost of there. So that's the biggest thing I see with the program. There's opportunities, like everything, to explore. I think it might be something that would be better suited maybe towards the south for long-term gardening more year-round, because you've got to maintain the water for the fish and the quality. So it becomes a more of a year-long type project than just a short growing season. And one of the things I think most of us are focusing on here is eating what you can grow during the season when you eat. And not changing the environment. You know, we plant what's in season, we eat what's in season, and what grows within 150 to 200 miles of our home. So I think that's kind of the way I address it.
I think most people would agree that's a good place to start. John, welcome to Kansas City's premier radio program, Central Standard. Welcome to Central Standard, John. Hello? You don't have John? Dave and Miriam, welcome to Central Standard.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I think the future farmer looks like a whole lot more of them. The fossil fuel energy that we're using right now is going to get a lot more expensive in the short term and dwindle away. That'll make the monoculture farming just unsustainable. We'll need a lot more small and medium-sized farms to do the more intensive square foot growing multiple crops on the same land as they're doing at Cultivate KC. I see a lot more people involved because we're just going to have to slow down and find balance and stop getting all of our nutrients from far away, plant nutrients, and sending the leftovers way downstream. It's going to have to become local circles, local recycling and reusing of our local assets, and that'll require a lot more local local labor.
Thank you, Dave, for your contribution to the conversation on the future of farming and what the future farmer looks like. And speaking of which, we mentioned monocropping and monoculture. Brandon, what's the difference between being a farmer and being in the agribusiness? Many people are starting to draw that lean distinction. What's the difference?
Well, I mean, the agribusiness is more the business itself. And being a farmer is the person out there doing the work. And there's a big distinction between the two. You know, before, you know, like when my grandparents were farming, farming was farming. And now there's a business to be run. The margins are smaller. When my grandpa was around, you planted it, you sold it. You didn't worry about having to market it. There's the business of marketing has turned the industry into agribusinesses. You know, and so you have to market your product, whether you're on a half acre or, you know, thousands of acres. Everybody has to market their product. We're in a, you know, somewhat a global economy, you know, and so we have to turn those, you know, marketing. So there's a lot more aspects to farming than there was 50, 60 years ago that we have to keep in mind. And so it's more of a business now than it used to be.
And part of that is a lot of the use for a lot of the crops for non-food purposes, maybe such as feed, maybe such as fuel.
Plastics. Yeah. I mean, there's, you know, millions of things that are made from corn and soybeans, some of these monoculture crops that don't come to mind right off the bat that are recyclable, you know, and things that biodegradable or more biodegradable than other products. And so it's a whole nother industry. You know, before, you know, 50 years ago, maybe even longer, all we did was eat the food, you know, or we fed animals with it. Now there's an industry revolved around finding alternative and looking for alternatives that we can use instead of petroleum products. And so some of these monoculture crops like corn and soybeans produce these organic oils that can be made into products that we would traditionally use fossil fuels for. So there is a place for those, you know, in the future.
But Sarah DeHart, at the local farms, it's about eating the food.
It is about eating the food. You know, and I think that, like I said earlier, there is definitely a market for, a growing market for the local food economy. And people, you know, I think just 15 years ago or just 10 years ago, there were 15 farmers markets in the Kansas City metro area. And today there are 53 or 54. I think that shows not only an increased interest in it, but it also shows an increase in the importance of creating access points for people to get that local food there. I mean, that there is a demand for that. And you know, we certainly on these 2 acres that we farm at the Gibbs Road Farm, we certainly don't have any sort of excess to be selling for the creation of plastics or anything
right.
or anything as such. You know, but again, it is part of a larger whole.
Rachel, what role do the immigrant farmers your organization works with play in the distinction between smaller farms and corporate farms?
All of the farmers that I work with are only growing on smaller farms. So we have our training farm site. It's 9 acres. Folks grow on a quarter acre. Each family has their own quarter acre. So it sounds like nothing, a quarter of an acre of land. But they do use direct marketing channels, CSA, farmers markets, wholesale accounts. And people are able to produce a lot of food on that size land. We had folks that sold $18,000 worth of vegetables out of a quarter of an acre last year. They're planting really intensively and doing a lot of rotational planning. And then when they move off of the training farm, they're able to access more land. Like some of our farmers have bought up to 2 acres, and so they're scaling their business up, but still scaling up for them is, you know, to a lot of people would seem really small on just a few acres.
I'm going to go to Joshua in Shawnee. Welcome to Central Standard, Joshua.
Thanks so much for taking my call. I had a question about, in particular, the awareness in the area about permaculture and the perennial grain agriculture that the Land Institute out in Salina is doing, and if there's any collaboration with local farmers and how that's taking place in the area.
Permaculture. Anybody have any thoughts on that?
Well, I've also heard a question about the grain.
Right.
And something that actually is just starting right now, there's an intern that just began at Cultivate Kansas City, and one of her projects this summer is to start connecting the dots and finding sources for local organic grain and kind of connecting those resources and connecting farmers both with each other and also with, I think, more distribution outlets and distribution channels. So that's definitely something that's happening. On the permaculture side, there is definitely a lot of permaculture that's happening in the Kansas City area.
Now, define permaculture for some of our listeners that may be listening and don't know about the subsets of agricultural components.
The word itself is the combination of two words, permanent agriculture.
Right, right.
And so basically it is the use of crop rotation and the use of like deep mulching, for example, in order to create a more sustained self-feeding and self-fertilizing system that's going to be sustainable over the long term so that you can over time reduce your agricultural inputs, and quite specifically agricultural inputs that are going to be needed to be brought in from off of the farm. So in terms of the grain, like I had mentioned, there is a move right now in order to try to help connect farmers with distribution outlets for the grain. In terms of permanent agriculture or permaculture, there is a lot going on in the city around that, and there's also a lot going on. The Kaw Valley Permaculture Institute out of Lawrence does a lot of workshops and has a program that will help people learn to develop those skills as well, so that they can implement some of those tactics into their cropping and their planting.
John in Kansas City, Missouri, welcome to Central Standard.
Good morning. John, actually, I live in Wasina, Kansas with Good Acres. I'm a small farmer. I know Brandon quite well, and I'm really enjoying the discussion this morning about local produce and what the farmer looks like in the future. One of my only fears is across the country, there's only about 3% of farming is fruits and vegetables, and the rest of it is row crop. And I realize a lot of the corn and soybeans that's raised here were in the breadbasket of the United States. It's a little scary that, you know, the corn fructose, that it's in our energy drinks and making, you know, the rise of obesity and all the other illnesses and diabetes and everything. So it's an awareness. I think it's working from the grassroots up. There is an awareness, and that, you know, I attend, you know, farmers market, the city market, you know, Brandon's parents, and real hard workers and farming, and they've transitioned probably from commercial farming more into raising fresh fruits and vegetables, and, you know, and I honor that, and, you know, I'm just a big part of a whole, but it starts with that awareness and just the ability and wisdom, learning each and every day of how to improve and what people want.
What do you think of that, what your farming colleague John says. Brandon?
No, I definitely agree. I mean, it's about creating awareness. I mean, and it's about thinking outside the box. Right now we don't have the answer. We're in the process of figuring out the answer. And with groups like this and talking about the situation, making public aware of the situation, it's going to spur more conversations and make people aware of how we need to address the situation. As a whole, the public's going to tell us, you know, kind of where they want our food to come from. And there's a lot of, you know, Kansas City is a great example. There's a lot of vacant land that can be used to make small or large gardens per se to feed the city, you know. And then the further out away from you get from a lot of these cities, there's a place where you could have these larger farms. But close to the core, you know, you can grow the fruits and vegetables and things like that.
You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 FM KCUR. We're streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm your host, Jabalani LaFall. This is our second installment on the future of farming as part of an ongoing collaboration with Harvest Public Media. Our guests are Brandon Farmeyer, a third-generation farmer of Farmeyer Family Vineyard and Farm in Lexington, Missouri, and Rachel Pollack, New Roots for Refugees is the organization she's with via Catholic Charities, and Sarah DeHart, a second-year apprentice at Cultivate KC's Gibb Road Farm in KCK. Kansas City, what do you think the farmer of the future looks like? Give us a call at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or shoot us an email at centralstandard@kcur.org. Carolyn in Prairie Village. Welcome to Central Hi. Standard.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. The future of farming for me is at home. One of my good friends has a huge garden in her backyard. I go over and, you know, help take care of the garden and take food home. Her aunt takes all the fruits that they have and makes jellies and jams, and they preserve it and use it throughout the rest of the year. And I think that's something that, you know, anyone with a backyard, with a friend with a backyard, anyone who has access to a community garden can do, and that helps cut down on their own food costs at the grocery store, and also helps teach them, you know, how to become aware of the land, aware of what you're using, and take care of it so you can keep doing this community gardening for the future.
Thank you very much for your contribution to this conversation. A tweet from Isaac Phillips, he's a hog and beef farmer up in Iowa, tells us that the farmer of the future will have to be a jack of all trades. Lawyer, attorney, chemist, farmer, marketing whiz. Do you find that to be true, Brandon?
Yes. It's a very simple answer. It's yes. And you also have to have a good team. I mean, you have to know there's things that are outside our expertise. You know, we concentrate on farming. We've realized as the farm has evolved from traditional ag into the winery and the vineyards and the produce that we need to concentrate on growing the products and doing what we do the best and then leave some of the lawyers and things like that. But you definitely have to be aware of all of those aspects. It's kind of a jack of all trades for sure.
Do you find, Sarah, that coming from the corporate background, you have a better sense of how each line of succession works?
I don't necessarily think that I have a better sense than anyone else, but I definitely see the importance of having a very, very diverse skill set, from knowing how to read land and read plants to having, you know, the capability for social interaction in a market situation or when working with wholesale customers and wholesale outlets. Also, you know, from a marketing standpoint, being able to be fairly well versed on tweeting and Facebook and knowing what's going on there, I mean, it's absolutely crucial. And then on top of that, you have to be able to know how to, you know, get down and dirty and get some tools in your hands and know how to use those tools and know what for and what's going to be the best tool for the job.
Sandra in McLeod, Kansas, welcome to Central Standard.
Hi, this is Sandra. I just wanted to ask you if you guys had any input on women farmers starting out. I was wondering if there are any grants or programs or anything that could help in that process.
Sarah DeHart, programs for women farmers starting out?
I wouldn't be able to say with absolute certainty of exact programs, but I do know that there's definitely grant funding that's out there that will not necessarily favor, but is directed more towards women and minorities. I do know that beginning farmers are comprised of a majority of women in terms of small business farmers. And I think that that says a lot just in terms of, you know, the entrepreneurial, you know, small-scale entrepreneurial industry. Farming, small-scale farming is one of those, and that's there's been definitely a huge jump in women farmers. The founder of Cultivate Kansas City, Catherine Kelly, farmed the land that we are on since 1997 organically, and she is a great representative of what's happening. And there are so many women farmers that I see at market and that I talk to. A lot of the New Roots for Refugees farmers are women. We share a greenhouse with them at Gibbs Road Farm, and a majority of them are women that are coming in as well.
We have Chad in Belton. Welcome to Central Standard.
Hi, guys. Good program. My question is, where do migrant workers fit into all of this? And I'll give you some backstory. Here in Belton, we're pretty progressive in terms of trying to assist families that are newly here from Mexico. We have a welcome center, and it's staffed by folks that speak Spanish. And, you know, those families that come in, we want them to be successful in our schools, and we point them toward health care, and we point them toward possible employment. I'm just wondering, with small-scale farming, has there been any talk about marrying those two worlds between folks that need employment and perhaps farmers that could use the assistance? And I'll listen off the air. Thanks.
Chad wants to know about the role of migrant workers. You deal with immigrant workers and foreign workers that come in to farm, and you pair them up with farms. Where do migrant workers come in?
You know, I can't really speak very much. That's not really my experience. All the folks that I work with are coming as refugees to the United States. I do know that there are a lot of migrant farm workers, especially around Lexington, where folks are assisting and working on farms there. But I really can't. Maybe you can speak more to it.
When it's going to be a huge part of more perennial crops. For instance, we have to use migrant labor in the vineyards. Because it's a seasonal crop, we're going to pick all the grapes within 8 weeks to make all the wine. The apple orchards, the peach orchards out near Lexington, Waverly, and Dover, those are done with mostly migrant labor that comes in and kind of follows the crops throughout. It's a big labor pool that comes in all at one time. So there's a segment that needs that. And then we've also seen locally that a lot of them have looked, just stayed. They like the Kansas City area. And so now they're looking for full-time employment. So there's more opportunity there as well.
And by the way, a quick plug. At Harvest Public Media, they did a series on women farmers. And there's also a documentary from Clay Masters on migrant workers and immigrant farmers as well. For more information on both of those series, very compelling, informative series. By the way, harvestpublicmedia.org is where you can visit the website and learn more about these agricultural projects and happenings around the world, really. In order to understand where the farmer of the future is and what that farmer looks like, it's important to note what farmers by and large look like today. Harvest Public Media, for instance, notes that for every one farmer and rancher under the age of 25, there are five who are 75 or older, according to U.S. Department of Agriculture statistics. To that end, what would you say to a beginning farmer who's under 25? What would you say to your kids, Brandon Farmer, who maybe might want to get into farming? I mean, farming is very old man's game or old person's game right now, according to the statistics.
I'd smile at them and say, look at the opportunity, because they're not going to be around forever. With the tools on monoculture, that if you look at that number and break it down, probably more the food grown farmers that are doing the labor intensive, like the ladies here today, it's probably a lot younger. When you look at the owner, those are probably more the monoculture farmers and the maybe some livestock producers and things like that, which the tools that have created with technology have made it easier for you to be older and still accomplish those goals. But the younger, more high-intense labor is still a younger crowd farmer. I mean, but I would say look at the opportunities that are coming forward for the younger generation. There's just a gap between us. So there's going to be opportunity for farmers that may not have second or third generations to take over. It's going to be our job as a community to pair people that want to start farms and move, match them up.
And who's going to inherit the farm after you?
I have three daughters. My brother has a young son. Hopefully that they'll like it as much as we do and want to come back with us.
What indications have they given you so far?
Mine are 6'4" and 17 months. So they're they dig in the dirt, but
right. Sarah, as more urban communities get involved in farming, how do you think that shapes the future of the farmer?
I think that it has the ability to shape it in many, many ways. And I think that as more of these farms pop up, we'll see how it works. I know that just here in Kansas City, there is, you know, Cultivate Kansas City, that organization's name has been thrown around a few times in this conversation. And it was established specifically to play a role and to help develop the role that urban agriculture can play in the community and can be a part of the community. And its mission is three-part. It's to grow food, and it's to grow farmers, and it's to grow the community. And I think that, you know, small-scale farming can definitely play a huge part in the education of the importance of eating locally and eating healthy. I think that that can be a boost to the local economy. I also think that it can help in terms of the overall health of the economy. And, you know, overall, I think that it can just grow the community and kind of help us better root ourselves and be more of a community.
We're discussing the future of farming and what the farmer of the future looks like. The second in a series and an ongoing collaboration with Harvest Public Media. Our guests have been Brandon Farmeyer, third-generation farmer from Farmeyer Family Vineyard and Farm in Lexington. Rachel Pollack is with the New Roots for Refugees Farming Program. And Sarah DeHart is a second-year apprentice at Cultivate KC's Gibbs Road Farm. Thank you all for coming today on Central Standard.
Thank you so much.
And if you'd like to know more about this series on the future of farming or women farmers or agriculture and agribusiness and energy production in general, very interesting stuff over at harvestpublicmedia.org. That's harvestpublicmedia.org. And tune in tomorrow when we explore the lasting influence of ragtime music as seen through the lives of Missouri legend Scott Joplin and hear about a local documentary remembering a character named Motley. That's on tomorrow's show. Our show is produced by Andrea Salenzi with help from Charlie Upchurch. Up to Date is next with a look at Dorothy Wickenden's bestseller, Nothing Daunted. I'm Jabalani LaFall. This is Central Standard. Enjoy your day.